The topic is actually W.E.B. Du Bois on Africa and in Africa. 100 years after the publication of The Souls of Black Folk, there is in the entire body of social criticism, no more than a handful of meditations on the promise and failings of democracy in America to rival William Edward Burghardt Du Bois's extraordinary collection of 14 essays, among the discerning commentaries on the American social contract, of which those of Alexis de Tocqueville, Henry Adams, and Lord Bryce, André Siegfried, Richard Hofstadter, and Michael Harrington are staples, Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk has pride of place for moral rigor and intellectual prescience. It transformed the history of thrice 100 years of black and white interaction on the North American continent with a suddenness so unprecedented as to divide the understanding of race into the time before and the time after the book's appearance. Above all, it was its depiction and diagnosis of the condition of blackness in a democracy distorted by white skin privilege that inscribed Du Bois's text with an incomparable analytical puissance. He foretold a racializing of poverty in America, the putting of an indelible face of color to failure that would preclude not only broad-based commitment to economic remediation for people of color, but would vastly complicate the possibility of any national politics that seriously addressed the maldistribution of wealth as the everlasting bane of a truly democratic social order. In his magisterial 1935 book, Black Reconstruction in America, Du Bois would call a widespread conviction that the unregulated market economy determined best the social application of the nation's fabulous material resources. He would call it the Great American Assumption, better known to historians as the creed of American exceptionalism. This doctrine is one of the oldest pseudo-verities animating the Republic. It holds that history weighs lightly upon the land and its people, that progress in all its dimensions is linear and infinite in the United States, and that the power of individuals to shape their destinies has been and remains unparalleled in the human experience in America. But what was true for some Americans was much less true for many others, and for some it was not at all true. It befell critics such as W.E.B. Du Bois to speak for the marginalized and the excluded by bringing to the agora of American concerns messages of distress, of increasing alarm, and ultimately of condign reproach. A searing passage in The Souls of Black Folk exclaims, therefore, and an approximation of Du Bois's voice, "To be a poor man in a land of dollars is hard. To be a poor race is the very bottom of hardship." By the time Du Bois made his well-timed exit on the eve of the historic 1963 March on Washington, he had repeatedly proclaimed in so many words that the cash line was the problem, the cardinal problem of the age. A quarter century after uttering his famous 1899 tagline, a 57-year-old Du Bois reflected upon the staying power of his pronouncement in the magazine Foreign Affairs. "Once upon a time in my younger years, and in the dawn of this century, I wrote, 'The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line,'" he stated. "It was a pert phrase which I then liked, and which since I have often rehearsed to myself, asking how far it was prophecy and how far speculation." But now in 1925, Du Bois paired class with race, stipulating in the journal that our present problem of problems is what we call labor. Another quarter century passed, and Du Bois revisited again the evolving implications of his color line prophecy. in his preface to the 50th anniversary edition of The Souls of Black Folk, he offers a final word on the subject. "I still think today, as yesterday, that the color line is a great problem of this century. But today I see more clearly than yesterday that back of the problem of race and color lies a great problem which both obscures and implements it. And that is the fact that so many civilized persons are willing to live in comfort, even if the price of this is poverty, ignorance, and disease of the majority of their fellow men. That to maintain this privilege, men have waged war until today. War tends to become universal and continuous, and the excuse for this war continues largely to be color and race. To Du Bois, the real problem of the century, therefore, was above all, the manipulation of race in the service of wealth. And the clairvoyant Du Bois greatly feared that the odds increasingly favored the manipulations by the rich. There is no way in the world for us to preserve the ideals of a democratic America, he wrote in the progressive news weekly National Guardian, save by drastically curbing the present power of concentrated wealth. Or else we descend into a military fascism which will kill all dreams of democracy, or the abolition of poverty and ignorance, or of peace instead of war. As the decade of the 1950s wound down, Du Bois, principal architect of the early civil rights struggle in America, spoke and wrote almost entirely about the global struggle for political and economic advancement and about the excesses of the American military-industrial complex. In a variation of the saying that all politics are local, he reasoned in the wake of Brown v. Board of Education that all civil rights are global. That, as he wrote in his feisty 1957 Cold War pamphlet, The American Negro and the Darker World, the ultimate value of citizenship for Africans in America would mean very little if Africans and Asians were to be subjected to a Pax Americana under the corporate rule of monopolized wealth. There were, of course, many sources for Du Bois's evolving global perspective on race and human rights. Among the most salient of them, certainly, was his precocious intellectual investment in the continent of Africa. If Pan-Africanism originated with a dimly remembered West Indian barrister, the copyright to the concept belonged to Du Bois. His first monograph, published in 1896, addressed the suppression of the African slave trade to the United States. His last, a thin 1961 book in Russian entitled Africa, Toward a History of the Continent and Its Inhabitants, remains unavailable in English. All told, of the 17 nonfiction books authored by Du Bois, six were about Africa. Three of them, the 1939 Black Folk Then and Now, the 1945 Color and Democracy, and the 1947 World and Africa, may still be read with profit. Colonies are the slums of the world, is Du Bois's starting, opening sentence in Color and Democracy. He wrote a mountain of essays, articles, and op-eds about Africa. One of those essays, The African Roots of the War, written in 1915, is a dazzling meditation on the political economy of imperialism. In large measure, it was only as the author of The Souls of Black Folk demystified the African continent that he arrived at a satisfactory demystification of the souls of white folk. The title of his stunning essay in the 1920 collection, Darkwater, Voices from Within the Veil. You may recall that in that essay, The Souls of White Folk, Du Bois wrote that the discovery of personal whiteness among the world's peoples is a very modern thing, a 19th and 20th century matter, indeed. And he added, today we have changed all that, and the world, in a sudden emotional conversion, has discovered that it is white, and that by that token, wonderful. Du Bois's deepening understanding of African experience enabled him to historicize the enveloping European racialisms of his day. "What is Africa to me?" he asked in his autobiographical Dusk of Dawn. "Once I should have answered the question simply, I should have said fatherland, or perhaps motherland." He wrote those words in 1940, almost 70 years after first becoming aware of Africa as a child in the mountains of western Massachusetts. As with much else to do with the early history of his Burkhardt family, Du Bois has left several confusing and contradictory accounts of the ancestor he called the little black Bantu, who sang a sad West African tune still heard at the fireside of his childhood. "Dobana koba, genime, genime, bendinuli, bendele." Du Bois never learned the meaning of her song, whose exact origin and translation have continued to defy linguists. Perhaps the best hypothesis suggests that it was a Wolof song from Senegambia about confinement or captivity. "Genime, genime, get me out, get me out." In three remembrances of his Burkhardt kin, Darkwater, 1920, Dusk of Dawn, 1940, and the autobiography, 1968, he variously ascribes the one who rocked and crooned the African song to his great-great-grandmother and his great-grandmother. But it was the influence of the song rather than the singer who mattered. It was Du Bois's one truly palpable tie to that African homeland he would spend an academic and political lifetime trying to interpret and shape. "Africa is, of course, my fatherland," he would write 16 years after spending a few months during 1923 in Monrovia, Liberia. "What is it between us that constitutes a tie which I can feel better than I can explain?" As the ambassador has suggested this morning, the ancestral song had been the earliest prompting of a very New England and supremely intellectual boy to try to discern a few true notes of a remote, vestigial, and mysterious heritage. The African Roots of the War, appearing in the May 1915 issue of Atlantic Monthly, was one of the analytical triumphs of the early 20th century. Du Bois poured into it his maturing ideas about capitalism, class, and race, anticipating by 2 years Lenin's lodestar monograph, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. The essay opened with a novel proposition that, quote, "in a very real sense, Africa was the prime cause of the First World War." Using a quotation from Pliny as his text, "Semper novi quid ex Africa," Africa is always producing something new, Du Bois passed in kaleidoscopic review the history of the continent from the European Renaissance to its partition at the Berlin Conference. The African Roots of the War enumerated the flashpoints in the scramble for Africa that already had just missed igniting an earlier European war. France and England at Fashoda, Italy at Adjoa, Italy and Turkey in Tripoli, England and Portugal at Delagoa Bay, England, Germany, and the Dutch in South Africa, France and Spain in Morocco, Germany and France in Agadir, and the world at Algeciras. "We speak of the Balkans as the storm center of Europe," Du Bois conceded, "but the ownership of materials of men and of materials and men in the darker world is the real prize that is setting the nations of Europe at each other's throats." Borrowing insights from J.A. Hobson's 1902 classic book, Imperialism, source text for much of 20th century's neo-Marxism, Du Bois disclosed one of the great paradoxes of triumphant European and American democracy. "The white working man has been asked to share the spoils of exploiting chinks and niggers." It was no longer merchants, bankers, and industrialists monopolizing the spoliation of the planet. It is the nation, a new democratic nation composed of united capital and labor. This was the real secret of that desperate struggle for Africa, Du Bois contended. by threatening to send English capital to China and Mexico, by threatening to hire Negro laborers in America, as well as by old age pensions and accident insurance, we gain industrial peace at home at the mightier cost of war abroad. Today, we might observe that the collusion of labor with capital is verging on crisis under the impact of NAFTA and the outmigration of not only industrial but technology sector jobs from North America. For how much longer will first world consumers be able to buy the products imported from third world economies to which their first world jobs have been exported? An unsurprised Du Bois might well observe that by pointing out the exclusion of the undereducated and semi-skilled from a junior partnership in the spoils of international capitalism, he had predicted as much. Only the aristocracy of labor need apply, he had warned. In Du Bois, the Pan-African idea found an intellectual temperament and organizational audacity, enabling it to advance beyond the evangelical and literary to become an embryonic movement whose cultural, political, and economic potential would assume in time, in the long term, worldwide significance. No other person of color then living, with the significant and calamitous exception of Marcus Garvey, was more capable of articulating the idea and mobilizing others in its service. For the first time in history, conditions were propitious for the construction of a global movement to advance the common cultural and political objectives of people of color. Du Bois had written in the crisis, as he announced the convocation of the Second Pan-African Congress to be held in London, Brussels, and Paris during the summer of 1921. Pan-Africanists had nothing to fear but fear of their own audacity, he might have written, and racial parochialism. With that visionary passion for justice nurtured by his New England upbringing and present in every book from the suppression of the Atlantic slave trade onward, Du Bois rose above particularisms to deliver the same solution to Arkansas pogroms, organized labor's color bar, and white voting primaries as to South African land acts and the systematic brutality of Belgian cartels in the Congo. The absolute equality of races, physical, political, and social, is the founding stone of world peace and human advancement, Du Bois insisted. The men and women of color attending the three sessions of the Second Pan-African Congress came in large part because they needed to believe in Du Bois's vision, because they wished to make some commitment of time and money to an undertaking that, by virtue of its pure symbolism and undeniable incongruity with quotidian concerns, invested the predicament of living in a dark skin with ecumenical purpose. With Du Bois in the chair as secretary in the meeting hall across from Westminster Abbey, the Congress voted unanimous approval of a manifesto entitled To the World in late July 1921. Several speakers had gone out of their way to reassure watching European officialdom of their patient and realistic understanding of the burdens of empire. Still, in the context of the times, when the end of white supremacy was inconceivable even to the great majority of its victims, the manifesto's arraignment of two of the most powerful exploiters showed that conservatism and conciliation had definite limits. To the World ventured to excoriate Britain and the United States for falling far short of their own professed ideals of civil rights under a democracy and stewardship of subject peoples under the vaunted Pax Britannica. The world must face two eventualities, Du Bois intoned as he reached the conclusion of that document. Africa must either be assimilated completely by Europe on the basis of absolutely equal political, civil, and social privileges for its black and white citizens, or Europe must allow the rise of an autonomous great African state based on popular education, industry, and freedom of trade. Among the 120-odd men and women assembling in Paris for the third session of the Congress were delegates from Indochina, India, Madagascar, the Philippines, the British and French Antilles, the independent nations of Haiti, Liberia, and Ethiopia, more than 30 from the United States, and at least two or three persons, accounting to a third of the Congress, from every region of sub-Saharan Africa. Significantly, there were no delegates in Paris from the French, Spanish, and Italian portions of North Africa. The British government kept interested Egyptians away. The Paris edition of the New York Herald Tribune captured Du Bois's aspirations with canny fidelity. Quote, "The question of the status of the Negro in modern society," it reported, "is no longer a domestic problem of the United States or a parochial problem of Jamaica or a colonial problem. It is rather a great worldwide problem to be viewed and considered as a whole." Du Bois would brook no compromise of the principles of absolute racial equality and eventual rule of Africa by Africans, and not Africa ruled with the consent of Africans, as demanded by the first Pan-African Congress of 1919. Du Bois then proceeded to draft a second document, eloquently embodying the determination of the men and women meeting at London, Brussels, and Paris to see their concerns registered as dramatically and broadly as possible, his Manifesto to the League of Nations. Disappointing in practical terms, the London resolutions and the Manifesto to the League comprised one of the earliest displays by educated men and women of African descent of the dramatic art of racial protest and liberation acted out before a global audience, an early dress rehearsal of a production whose plot surprised and bemused those Europeans alert to its subversive meaning, but a drama still much too far ahead of its time, really, to alarm or even educate the white world audience. For Du Bois and his allies, though, the play was the thing. Performance was meant to be everything. For by acting as though they spoke for hundreds of millions of the darker world, by reading their provocative lines across the footlights of Europe, they intended to propitiate audiences for the new cultural and political roles that black people were determined to adopt in what he and they hoped would be their liberated, triumphant future. Even though Du Bois later admitted that it had been unrealistic to expect meaningful institutional modifications or broad policy shifts in the status quo founded at Versailles and at Geneva, his certainty that the germinal impact of the Second Pan-African Congress would ultimately transform global power relations never wavered. Still, Du Bois had yet to see the African continent until he manufactured the opportunity through a well-connected GOP contact.